Hey, my friends, welcome back to another episode of the Meaningful People Podcast. Hope you're doing well. This week I sat down with Avital Shizik Goldschmidt, Rebbetzin Avital, that is. She's the Rebbetzin of a beautiful shul in Manhattan, the Alt New Shul, and she's also one of the editors at The Real Deal. So listen up, guys. This is an important episode where really important, sensitive topics are discussed. So anytime we do something like this, it's important to note, you may not agree with the views said in this episode or any episode perhaps that we put out, and that is fine. Differences of opinions are okay. How we have that conversation though is important. Feel free to comment below, but please be civil. It's okay to have the important conversations. It's important to have the important conversations. If you'd like to win $200 by commenting on this episode, then do me a favor, comment the answer to this. Who should we interview next? Leave that comment down below on this episode, and one of you will be selected to win $200, and we may choose that person who you're suggesting. This episode is sponsored by my friends at PZ Deals. Yes, why pay full price when PZ Deals can be downloaded at your fingertips? Head to the App Store, to the Google Play Store, and download the PZ Deals app right now. Perm costume stuff? PZ Deals got deals on that. Flights for Pesach? PZ Deals got deals for that. Anything you can think of. Maybe you're thinking about getting your yard ready for the summer and there are certain accessories that you need. PZ Deals has that. Get notifications. Customize those notifications. You don't need to get notifications, but if you want to get notifications about certain items, you can select that. Anytime there's a price change, you can select that. Head to the PZ Deals app, download the PZ Deals app, and never ever pay full price again. This episode is also sponsored by my friends at Kollel Chabad. The Pushka app, that is. You know, I was on a flight recently and I, of course, took out my phone, went to the Pushka app right before takeoff, said Tefillah Sadarach, and I gave a few dollars to tzedakah. And I was shocked. Well, not really, but I looked next to me and I saw the person doing the same exact thing. The Pushka app is amazing. It is right at your pocket. Take it out, download the Pushka app, pushka.cc/meaningful. Kollel Chabad is helping to feed so many needy people all over Eretz Yisrael. And this Pushka app enables you to give tzedakah the easiest way possible. So don't sleep on this. Head to pushka.cc/meaningful. Tzedakah is an important part of our lives, and now it just got easier. Head to pushka.cc/meaningful. Rebbetzin, how do you pronounce your name?
Shizik Goldschmidt.
Yeah, Goldschmidt's way easier to pronounce.
Yes.
Shizik.
Shizik is my maiden name.
It's your maiden name. Where does it come from?
Ukrainian Jewish family. And I decided to keep it because a lot of my writing was actually published before I got married. I was quite young mm-hmm. when I started writing. So I decided to keep it because I didn't want
to lose
all those bylines.
That's very interesting. So your family is originally from Ukraine?
Yes. My father's from Kiev and my mom grew up in Russia, but her family's from Kharkov.
At what point? Oh, how long ago did they leave?
1979.
Okay.
A while back.
Yeah. And did them growing up there come out in the parenting with you? What is the relationship with you? And
Definitely. I think most Russian speaking Jews could attest to the culture playing a huge role in the way that you're raised, in your interests, the way that you spend your time. Obviously, there's a huge emphasis on educational and academic excellence, on culture. There's a lot. That love that comes into it, just being multilingual, yeah. Being a little bit sort of having a bigger worldview on things than maybe the typical American kid. So definitely, I was kind of raised in a very classic Russian Jewish household, but my parents were Balei Tshuva, so they became from as I was growing up. So that was sort of the unusual thing.
How'd that play out? Meaning becoming from sort of with you as you're getting older and...
My parents always sent us to Jewish day schools. Thank God. They were very passionate about giving us the education that they never got in the Soviet Union. So in some ways, I feel like I was an FFB because I went to day school my whole life. There was no shock in that. But in some other ways, definitely, I feel like a BT. I feel like a lot of like my frumkeit was a conscious choice because my parents were growing as I was growing up. I think it's a very healthy way of becoming from, by the way. I see a lot of people exploring, and I'm so happy to see them exploring, but sometimes they go too fast and they're not ready for it. And I think sort of taking your time, just like piece by piece, mitzvah by mitzvah, then maybe get to the menhagim, you know, like going at it in a very healthy way. It's very important.
So like someone who's becoming from kind of like become from with your kids, like a kid's getting older, he's 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, they're taking things on slowly, sort of like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Taking things on slowly, like you first learn not to turn off the lights on Shabbos, then you, oh, ripping toilet paper is not okay. Okay.
I think
oh,
they probably feel off. They probably feel like this urgency. Like I spent so many years not doing the mitzvahs yeah. and not keeping Shabbos that they feel like, oh, now I get it. I got to just do it all. And it probably leads to burnout a lot of times.
Burnout. Or just like, it's just over. Yeah, it's just overwhelming. It's too much. Or sometimes I see people, a lot of belly tshuva. Now I see this in my work also communally. Sometimes they'll go straight for like sometimes the hardest things or the things that they think are like sort of identifying markers. And there's a reason for that. There's a good reason for it. But they will often sort of miss core things and like core, you know, education and just like understanding like what halachic observance looks like. What does it entail? What does it require? Those are steps that are sometimes yeah. missed.
Right. You mentioned that you've been writing from a very young age.
Yeah.
There's a few storylines at play in an episode like this. There's you're a Rebbetzin over here in the Upper East Side, which is awesome. It's really cool. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
There's your career. You're a writer. I know you work for The Real Deal. Mm-hmm. That just got a lot of real estate guys in the Five Towns very excited to hear that. Oh wow, Real Deal. Like
yeah.
And you also you're very passionate on community issues.
Yes.
And you write about that.
Very much.
So I guess take me back to those early years where you started writing. What did you write about?
So I think all of those things, like there are a lot of threads in my life.
Yeah.
But they all sort of root in the same thing, which is what I mentioned to you earlier. It's about storytelling and also about and rooted in that passion. I see a lot of both my journalism work and my work as a Rebbetzin very much rooted in the same love for the community, wanting it to improve, wanting to represent and tell stories that may not be always told. And we'll get to the community yeah. aspect. But yes, I was always a writer from a young age. I started writing when I was 7 years old. And I just wrote stories and books and poems the way that a lot of kids do. What changed for me was in high school, I went to Berea High School. And I started submitting stories to various publications and contests, just like, you know, trying national mm-hmm. competitions. And thank God I was able to compete and win some national things that were sort of very weird for like a from girl from like, you know, a girl's school to be getting into. But I was very passionate about it. I really wanted to excel. And that sort of set me on the state on the path, I would say, to writing professionally, because I sort of, even at a young age as a teenager, it's such a formative time and you feel so insecure and you don't know who you are and what do you really want to do and what are your dreams. And these things really allowed me to sort of feel more confident that, yeah, I really should be a writer. So that was my teenage years. I went to Stern and there I was, you know, always writing and publishing. And then the big moment that sort of I think broke kind of the breakthrough moment was I was 20 years old. I was in my final year of Stern and I wrote an essay that I cold pitched to Tablet. And it was a reflection on what I described as chumrah culture. People sort of like taking on chumras and using them as a way to like socially show, you know, they're holier than thou, right? Like keeping up with the Jones, but in terms of frumkeit. Mm-hmm. So I wrote about that experience and specifically how that often plays out in like girls' schools and like talking about tznius and all these things. So it was a very fiery essay. I was 20 years old.
Do you regret it?
No.
Okay. You'll tell me about the content of that essay. Like what was like the, yeah, what made it fiery?
It was no holds barred. I wrote it without thinking about what people will say or think. This is the early heydays of like when things used to go viral on Facebook. I don't know if you even knew about those days. Yeah.
Yeah.
When like links went viral and everyone was like, oh my gosh, you have to read this article. And it really did spread like wildfire at the time. People were talking about it. It obviously struck a nerve.
Imagine, yeah, people must have agreed. Either people really agreed or people really disagreed. And that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. Or very often I find, by the way, it's fascinating writing about things in the firm community. People like, they want to hate it, what you said, but they know it's true, right? And like, they can't really look away from it. And that's, I think, part of the role of a writer on society is being able to reflect those things. Not to always, by the way, give an opinion. Sometimes it's just to reflect a reality that exists. So
do you think everything is meant to be written about, though? Like, maybe there are some things that...
Written about and published are two different things.
Published. Writing, anyone could write. You write.
Yeah.
You can write until your hand falls off, you know, all day for sure. But to publish, you know, yeah. What do you think about that?
Great question. I think it depends on the writer. I think it depends on the publication. I think it depends on how one goes about it. That's something I've learned over the years, like with humility, being humbled by reality and difficult situations and difficult stories that I've worked on. I believe I've never regretted a single article I've written. I'll start with that.
Written or published?
Published. Okay. Good catch. I've never regretted anything. I think it's important to always keep in mind where you're publishing things. And it's a hard thing for someone like me to write, to say, because I've historically written for for secular publications and about from issues. For the most part, almost always, that was because I didn't really see a home for those conversations and stories in our own publications. We all know that from publications are not interested in publishing those types of conversations or in the way that they're written. So I've had to go to secular homes, but it's a very bidi-evid approach.
But what is the value of writing about from issues in a secular publication? I mean, you're not really... you're speaking down to them.
The great Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem wrote a novel called Wandering Stars. I recently read it. And it's about two kids who basically leave the shtetl, go off to Derech, and become theater stars. And in it, he describes a phenomenon that I was fascinated by. He's describing Jews in the late 19th century in England, the sort of the aristocratic Jews of London. And he's describing how he says, people don't really take you seriously as a Jew if you only make it in a Jewish space. Meaning Jews don't really take you seriously. Meaning the Yiddish theater was sort of like a ceiling that they would hit, these actors with big dreams. Really, they wanted to get into the stage in the Gentile theater. And once they made it into the Gentile theater, that's when the Jews started paying attention. Meaning the Jews didn't really take it seriously when they were just playing for Jews. It was only when you make it in the Goyische Welt, that's when people take it seriously. And I think there's something so true and eternal about that, unfortunately, right? But I think there is something to it, because I think people take it much more seriously when it's published in a bigger setting, often with higher standards, frankly.
Can that be looked at as airing or dirty laundry, though?
Some people say that. Some
people agree with that?
I think don't fault those who are doing the laundry. Fault the ones who dirtied it in the first place.
Well, I think, you know, cool heads can... By the way, this is like, I'm not...
Yeah, go for it.
Are you open to this open dialogue?
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
I'm just on...
Nothing's off the
record. It's on the fly.
Today.
Like, yeah. I'm really just, you know, I want to boil down and really, you know, get to this. But we all know that the people who are dirty in the laundry are bad actors. And they're not... And they don't represent the firm community. They don't represent us. That being said, giving them that platform... Like, you know what? Like, someone who... you know, sheds light on, let's say, Leif Tahar cult.
Yes.
I personally, I feel like that's such a bad thing. They are a fringe group who are really, really sick, and they don't represent Jews at all. Now, what happens when they're on Fox News or CNN or they're in a premiere? Okay, the average person out there in the world cannot differentiate between that person and the person walking in Williamsburg in the street, and they think they're the same people. So that really puts us at a real disadvantage.
Very much so. I think you're making a good point. And that's actually why I said that it really depends on where you publish things and also the angle, the person writing it. I approach every story I do with this sort of big question of, you know, when it's a kind of story that makes me concerned about that. And the question is it a fringe incident? Is it a fringe person? Is it someone who has... massive influence, or is it a trend in the community that really affects many people? And it's not like a little, it's not a small thing. And that's a really hard examination that one has to go through when doing that. Now, I agree with you. I actually think it's so interesting. I was never interested in writing about Leif Sahor for that reason, because I always felt, I mean, it's voyeuristic and it's fascinating how cults work and all that, but I wasn't really actually interested in, I didn't feel it was worth my time per se. But there have been definitely stories that I've done over the years that have been very controversial around, you know, abuse is just like an easy one to talk about because I think it's just like a really good litmus test when we talk about these issues. But I think it's true of like Agunos, it's true of other issues in the community that we talk about. My recent, I had a big article about materialism. All these issues, you know, you have to look at them and see how much do they really impact the community. Is the person or is this trend really hurting vast swaths of people, or is it something, and is it something that needs to be stopped? Maybe, you know, if it was something that I know happened 20 years ago, I'm not going to invest time into it. If there's a chashash, if there's a concern that that thing is continuing, that that issue is continuing, I do believe it is our duty to report it.
For sure. I mean, if there are people who are getting hurt,
yeah,
then I don't know any Torah authority that would say it's, you let that be.
The thing that most from readers don't understand is that I have many, many times consulted with Das Torah on these things, on whether to write something, whether to publish something, or whether to go public with various situations. And I've never had the experience of asking, and I always ask the right people. That's really important. People who are brilliant and understand these sort of moral questions. I've never heard the word no, don't put it out. It's a Chilul Hashem. Not once. Because they were all serious stories. And even machlokes in the community sometimes, I've literally had Rabbanim say, this is important. This has to come out. They're not saying they want to do it. They're not doing it. But they're saying it's fine.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I think most people don't realize that it's sort of, I think there's an assumption that if you're talking about issues or something in the community, that you're therefore like a rabble rouser or a troublemaker or something.
Do you have that rap? Like, do you have that reputation in the firm world of being that? I really
could do a survey.
What do you feel? Do you get bad? Do you get bad feedback when you, let's say?
Like, I'm sure. Yeah, I think in certain circles, I certainly do. So it was definitely more when I was starting out. Mm-hmm. Now it's sort of like I think people are just used to me. But I also am very particular, again, in what I take on and how I talk about things. For example, the article I just wrote about materialism, the From Community, I've been thinking about writing something like this for a while. I co-wrote it with Chaim Seyman, and we wrote it for Tradition, the journal. Now, what's interesting about that is that that is not my classic setting for
what
an article.
What type of audience do they have?
I would say, like, from intellectual, okay. Right? That is not really my usual audience, but the subject is so important, and I wanted to put it in a place where it would really be heard and read and taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that was internal.
About the piece. I mean, I didn't read it, so I'd love know.
It's like 30 pages long with many footnotes. So oh, wow. Print it out for Shabbos.
I'm a big audiobook guy.
Okay. Oh, we should record a reading of it.
Yeah. You'll cliff note it a little bit. Like, what drove you to, you know, write this article?
The editors approached us to co-write it, and we decided to really take on like this big, big picture approach to the subject, looking at the reality of American from materialism, how that has become a reality in our communities in a way that we argue is quite different from, you know, the bourgeoisie of a previous generation. It doesn't mean that there's always been wealth. There's always been, you know, Baruch Hashem, we've always been, parts of the community have always been blessed, right? Mm-hmm. That's true in America. That's true in Europe. That's true in Mizrahi countries, right? It's always been true. What has changed is the aspiration has changed. Access to understanding what that wealth looks like, what we want from it, and the way that also I think a lot of it has become very inextricably tied to religion, to faith, to the way that we observe mitzvot. That's sort of the thing that I was curious about with Chaim. So we did like this really deep dive. Part of it looked at Musser over the last few hundred years talking about this. Some fascinating subjects, excerpts from the Chafetz Chaim, talking about America as a sort of like, you know, this Domina Mora basically, where you go just to make money and you forget about your Torah. We did a study also of the history of Lakewood, right? The original Lakewood was built to be an antithesis to the materialism of the city of Brooklyn, right? Of whatever, the New York City area. Rev. Aaron Cutler went there to build an ascetic, quiet, world of Torah. And now Lakewood is what it is today with plenty of great things, but there are definitely challenges now. So it's like sort of an interesting, just like a paragon of where we've moved over the years. And then the other interesting thing we did was, if you're not a reader, you could take a look at it. We have a lot of graphics. We actually did side-by-side look at advertisements from the 80s and the Jewish Observer till today, looking at like, how was kosher wine advertised in the 80s versus today? How was a kosher hotel in Miami advertised then versus today? A sukkah, you know, all these kinds of things. And we did a side-by-side comparison and you see the shift, right? Whereas everything was about, you know, getting a great deal. And it was sort of just like, you're going to get, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was obviously it was the 1980s. The numbers are different.
Yeah.
But staying at a, you know, kosher hotel where it's like super, super simple and it's all inclusive.
It was like seeking and the best price at the.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a mitzia, right? And now it's like, no, now you want to spend because your ability to spend is your ability to show that you have it. Right. So the difference in that shift is really interesting. Or like a sukkah, the best deal for a sukkah. And then we compared it with like a white glove service luxury sukkah.
Would you say that this is like any issue? I don't think it's probably not exclusive to the From World. Obviously.
Yeah, we talked about that in the article as well.
You think
no,
it is?
I don't think so. I think it's very American.
But still, like, I don't know how it manifests in American culture in general, honestly.
I think from what I read,
McDonald's is still advertising they're cheap, you know, you can get a burger for sure. $2, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, but you have consumerism, no question, is on the rise within American society in general. A lot of it is because of social media, because we're targeted better by companies, and also because I think there's an element of sort of, you know, access. You have access to a 0.001% to seeing how they live. Flying private is now not a crazy thing when you are bombarded with it online, right? May be beyond our realities, but still you see it a lot, right?
Yeah.
So I think that sort of has shifted people's expectations to have a certain item, to have a certain status thing that has become much more normalized in general American society. And there's a lot of really interesting analysis of this broadly, like way outside the From community. But I think that the From community is definitely not immune to it. We are very much American. And we are also, and I think what's even more interesting is that a lot of it ends up getting tied to Fromkeit. Now, on one hand.
So tell me how that manifests.
Right. So on one hand, we're happy about that because if the rest of our lives are upgraded, right? We have a Baruch Hashem, we're able to afford something nicer or whatever, a better quality of life. And then our Judaism stays in that austerity of another generation, that would not be good. We're not looking to do that. But on the other hand, sort of maintaining expectations, I think is really important. I think a lot of it comes down to, I mean, we use small examples of it as sort of just as very concrete ways of detailing this, but you know, it's important. Again, a mikvah should be beautiful and it should be comfortable because that allows women to keep the mitzvah.
Yeah.
Right. Kosher food has exploded and it's incredible now what we have. There are so many more people who are able to keep kosher. I see it in Manhattan on a daily basis who are much more willing to keep kosher because the options are so amazing, right? That they don't feel that they're restricted really in a certain sense. So it's very enticing and it's great for Judaism in some ways. On the other hand, the problem is that when people feel that they're priced out of being observant Jews, you know, that's a real challenge. Chaval, like are we losing people because they feel that they're not able to keep up with this culture?
Hey, my friends, I'm heading to an ad break right now. Don't skip. I want to tell you first, the Meaningful People game right now, meaningfulminute.org/the game. Bring this podcast to your Shabbos table. Bring it to your dates. Bring it to your family gatherings. It is at a great price right now at meaningfulminute.org/the game. This episode is sponsored by my friends at the Aleph Institute. Yes, we've had members of their team on our podcast. I love the work that they do. Now, let me tell you something. Aleph Institute brings heart into the justice system. They work tirelessly to alleviate brokenness, loneliness, and reunite broken families and inspire new beginnings. Their work is extremely expensive, but they never charge a dime. On March 10th, 2025, Olive is hosting its annual gift auction, raising crucial funds to support the incredible work that they do. By purchasing a ticket in this auction, you're helping them. You're helping them take care of the families who have a family member behind bars. You're helping them take care of service members around the world. You're helping them make sure that those who are incarcerated still have a connection to their Yiddishkeit. Now, what can you win? How about a $36,000 grand prize? 5 tickets round trip to Israel, a brand new Shaitel, a luxury getaway with KMR, and a whole lot more. Over 50 gifts right now are on this auction. So I think what you want to do is join this. What you give by supporting Aleph is a second chance. It's advocacy. It's healing. It's friendship. It's sustenance. It's a hope for a better tomorrow. So how are you going to enter? It's very simple. Head to aleph.auction right now. That is aleph.auction right now. Or hit the link in the show notes below. Make sure to purchase a ticket. Help support Aleph's incredible work. March 10th is the auction. So don't wait. Get involved now. This episode is also sponsored by my friends at Lalechet. You know, I know of a shul over there in the Five Towns that just took 72 of their Mispalim and the Rav to Eretz Yisrael for a beautiful, beautiful trip. Now, who do they use from A to Z for this trip? Yes, that is right. You guessed it. Lalechet. You may have a dream of going with a family on a beautiful trip to see your family's heritage, or maybe, I don't know, anywhere in the world. Lalechet takes care of that from A to Z. The travel, the food, where you're going to go, where you're going to stay, who's going to give you a tour. You can literally reach out to Lalechet and say, hey, we have this idea of, I don't know, going to Morocco. My grandparents are from Morocco. I want to go visit. And they'll say, okay, we could take care of everything. Besides for that, they have trips set up that you can join. They have trips with Rabbi Gladstein. They have trips with Rabbi Besser. There are so many opportunities for you to tap into the heritage of the Jewish people through Lalechet. And you can also create your own trips. So head to Lalechet's website. That is lalechet.com. Lalechet.com. It's a beautiful website. It's very easy to use. You could build your own trip and go on one of their upcoming trips. It all starts at lalechet.com.
Well, our schooling is probably one of those big price tags.
Yeah. My husband said it this past week in his drasha. He said, it's an embarrassment in the American Jewish community that we have not figured out a way to make Jewish education affordable. It's an embarrassment. Because of the amount of money, the amount of resources that we have as a community. You know how many organizations there are fighting anti-Semitism?
A lot, yeah.
At least 60.
Yeah.
Do you know how much money is going into that? If you ask me.
Hundreds of millions, yeah.
Imagine if that money was going into actually just giving Jewish children education.
So I sat down with someone yesterday who's a president of a school. He's a very wealthy individual. And we spoke about this topic for 2 hours, really.
I want to hear about it.
You'll hear it. It's airing this weekend. I don't know whenever this airs, but yeah. It's airing this weekend. And I offered an idea. I said, listen, Albert Einstein University, they just got a gift for $1 billion and now it's free tuition.
Yeah.
So the from world, like we have this amazing wealth, like really, really. What if everyone, like we got into the room, all the Askanim and the wealthy people in New York and said, okay, let's raise $700 million and we're going to be able to knock tuition down in half. So it's not 13,000 or 16,000 a kid. It'll be seven, you know, six,
New
seven.
New York City, the numbers are different. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it's like 30, it could be $35,000 here for tuition, maybe, which in any event, cutting it in half would be a significant impact for a family. And I think the response that he said to me was it's not as attractive for people to give such money to yeshivas and Jewish schools. They want to give to organizations.
They want their names in a wall.
Yeah. So it's a very, I agree with you. The tuition thing is a really hard pill to swallow. Like at the same time, I do believe it is expensive for them to educate the kid. Where is it? Listen, this guy spoke at the Agoda convention, $350,000. He said a guy who makes $300,000, a family, there is no money to pay the tuition.
Yeah.
Family of five, family of six. The money's gone. What does that do to our community?
What does it do to our community? And what is it also doing in the business world? Which is something that I'm also seeing in my work actually at The Real Deal. Because a lot of our stories recently, unfortunately, have been covering business in the firm community. Various business individuals who have played
It might drive them to do things that are a little yes. nefarious.
Yes, exactly. And it's
because they have to keep up.
It's systemic. And if you listen, David Lichtenstein had an amazing podcast on this a few weeks ago. He literally had someone talking about this. Exactly. I came out of yeshiva. I had no education. I had no skills. Needed to make money fast. I had kids. And I ended up, you know, committing fraud and admits to it. And
knowingly.
I think,
knowingly. He just got into it?
He thought it was gray.
Okay.
But
what's gray is yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a real, there's a systemic issue in this. And it's really scary because of the cost of living. And again, there's yeshiva tuition and then there's the extras. But all of this combined is creating a community that requires, that pushes specifically, I think, young men into
impossible situations.
Impossible situations into professions, yeah. into businesses that are not 100% kosher. And this is something I'm hearing all the time in the street. And I'm seeing it also in my reporting and in my reporter's work. And they're always asking me, what's going on? You know, why is this happening in this community? And it's a very difficult position to be in.
You're saying, I haven't heard this take on it, but you're saying it's stemming from the pressure they're feeling
yeah.
because of the expenses that they're incurring. So let's pretend for a second we're sitting at a table that can solve this problem, can solve this issue. What idea? I mean, you mentioned, you and your husband said it, you said it's an embarrassment. This hasn't been figured out yet. Let's say you and your husband had the magic wand to say, we're going to, whatever we say goes and it's fixed. How do you fix it?
I mean, I think they're much smarter lay leaders and philanthropists than me, I'm not a philanthropist in any way, who would be able to advise better on this. But there has been discussion about creating, I think I saw something recently about this, that there is something being done, like a fund towards this, towards just subsidizing Jewish education. By the way, this is not an issue just for the firm community. This is an issue for American Jewry across the country. We have tons of Jewish children who know nothing about their heritage, who have zero access to day school. And I don't even need them to go to an Orthodox day school. Just go to day school. Know to read in Hebrew. Know who you are, right? And they don't even have access to it. The amount of kids I meet, when I say kids, like college age, post-college age, who come to Manhattan from beyond the New York City area, who never really had experience with, you know, any sort of observant Judaism.
They had no chance.
They maybe went to a Chabad preschool and wherever they lived, and then they had no chance to. And their parents, and I don't blame their parents. Many of the non-Orthodox day schools have also had to close because they were just not able to sustain themselves.
Right.
So I think this is just a Jewish issue, not only an Orthodox issue, number one. Number two, I think a lot of this is the answer relies on American funding, American Jewish philanthropists putting their money, you know, to where their mouths are. And number two, there's been some conversation about this, and I also did see that there is some movement on this, that the state of Israel should actually be investing into Jewish education, which is pretty
in
crazy.
America?
In diaspora, yeah.
Why?
Yeah, because a stronger American Jewish community only helps Israel. This is like a strategic, you know, way of thinking about this, to my mind. If they're able to think about all the tons of American Jewish kids.
What about the Jewish education in Israel? I mean, that is not even solid.
That's true.
I mean, I think we'd first say, hey, can you invest, you know, hundreds of millions of shekel into that?
Yes, but I do think that if you had to choose between the two, right? If you had to choose your priorities, I would actually prioritize diaspora Jewish education because the stakes are much higher, right? A kid growing up in Israel, chaval, he may not know, you know, much Tanakh or like whatever, the public school system is not great on certain things. But in the end of the day, child is most likely going to go through the army, is going to have interactions with religious individuals, will probably marry Jewish. I'm talking about like existential questions, right? I'm not talking about like, do they know who Shaul HaMelech was, right?
But you're talking about literally like someone who's stopping Jewish generations, meaning they're marrying out.
Very much. We see assimilation at incredible rates here in New York City.
That's really concerning.
Yeah, and this is New York, where there are tons of Jews, and you have a really great pool of potential match candidates. But we are definitely seeing that pull is very, very strong here.
Hmm. And we got here from materialism.
Yeah.
From the kiddush that's taking place in the shul, in this
yes.
from community, to intermarriage.
Well, I just spoke about this recently somewhere else. you know, the question of materialism often comes in when you're also leading a community and you're making choices. Where are we putting, where are we allocating budget towards? And people may disagree with our approach to these things, but one of the things we have really worked hard on is investing into nice events, kiddish primarily, that it be really just wonderful, full, a full meal, essentially, in order to fight assimilation. I'm not joking. We have, Baruch Hashem, quite a few matches who've already gotten engaged, who've already met at our kiddush alone. And we are, for us, that's a big priority. For us,
it's a big priority. When you say we, you say specifically in your community, in your shul?
Yeah, my husband and I, the board.
Tell me about that community. Tell me about the shul that you guys have. Like, what, who's, how'd that, you know, come about? What's the shul like?
It's a long story. We started around 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was not planned in any way. My husband was an assistant rabbi at another congregation in the neighborhood. And it was a very difficult time for us.
Right, I remember this.
It was very public controversy. We discovered some misconduct there and we were thrown out one day to the next. I was pregnant with our third child, didn't know what we were going to do. And the congregants called us and said, where are you davening this Shabbos? And we were like, where are you davening this Shabbos? Like, we literally, like, our health insurance was just cut off. We have nowhere to go. Like, we have nothing planned. Like, we don't know what's happening. And they said, well, wherever you're davening, we're davening. So we're like, I guess we'll have a minyan in our living room. And that's what we did. And then Baruch Hashem, the next Shabbos, we already, we had like 40 people show up in our living room. And then the next Shabbos, we already had to rent a space here on Park Avenue for, wow. I think we ran 250 people showed up that for wow. that second Shabbos. We sent out an invitation saying, you know, you're welcome to join us for Shabbos davening. And it was a crazy thing to think about because we were mired in a very complicated situation. And inside we were really traumatized and broken, and we were humiliated. But what we understood at a certain point, you could fight or you could build. You have to choose. We decided to build. So week to week, we rented various spaces around the Upper East Side, which is a very difficult thing to do, especially this is the end of COVID. This is when Omicron was still around.
It's quite expensive here, right? I take it.
It is not cheap. Baruch Hashem, we had patrons who went with us from the very beginning who said, we believe in you and what you could do here in Manhattan specifically. It was interesting. My husband was, you know, a few shuls reached out to him when everything happened. They were recruiting him to outside the city. And one of our mentors and patrons said, you know what? Those shuls can hire a great rabbi. There are tons of great rabbis for them to hire. You need to be in Manhattan. You need to be here in this neighborhood. And I think about that a lot because we didn't feel that way at all at the time. We were so insecure. We were like, who starts a new shul in the Upper East Side? That's insane.
Yeah.
Like, people thought we were crazy. But Baruch Hashem, week by week, we just started renting spaces and finding different private clubs. And it was a fascinating and very difficult experience. We were shul on wheels. We had an incredible staff managed by one of the community members who was just literally like moving Sidurim, Chumashim, Talisim, like Talisim. It was crazy from place to place. We landed at the Pierre Hotel. We rented the ballroom there because we were just getting so many people. Within a year, it was 500 to 600 people on a regular Shabbos morning.
Wow.
It was very insane. I think it really showed what a thirst there is in Manhattan, in this neighborhood, for something a little bit different.
What is that different?
A lot of things. So we named the shul the Altnoy, the Altnoy Synagogue.
Okay.
Idea being old and new. And that was very much our vision from the very beginning, where we take an unapologetic traditional approach, but with freshness, with innovation. And the mantra of the shul is actually Rav Kook's line, Hayashan Yitchadesh V'Achadash Yitchadesh, that the old should become new and the new should become holy. And that's how we sort of saw it. We wanted something that was absolutely orthodox, no questions asked, that was focused very much on Torah, on growth, on intellectual experiences, but also on soul, on spirit, having something with a heart. Manhattan is a really difficult, it's like a jungle. This place is a jungle.
Concrete jungle.
Concrete jungle, yeah. And it's difficult. And I think that there is, but there was clearly a need for something different. That is not, it's not a place that's specifically tied to one stream of Orthodox Judaism. And I think that was a strength for us, that we're very, it's pluralistic in that way, meaning people come from all over. You can have people who are literally just discovering Judaism sitting next to a Black Hatter in shul easily all the time.
Would you consider your work as sort of like Kiruv Chaikim?
There's a lot of Kiruv Krovim as well in this. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about the way that we go about it is that it's very challenging, but it's very important, is that every piece of content, we say piece of content, I'm thinking as a journalist, but really as a Revitzin, every drasha, every shir, every event is something that could speak to both someone totally not affiliated and also someone totally from with a day school education. And that's a really difficult thing to do because you have to be able to teach at a high level that's challenging, but at the same time accessible. But we see a need for that. And by the way, I think a lot of the mistakes that Kiruv professionals make is that they assume that the people they're working with are, I hate to say it, but like they're stupid. Like they literally assume that people are not intelligent. And it's pretty crazy to do that in a place like Manhattan where you have CEOs of companies, you have top doctors, top lawyers, people, professors of universities who are coming to shul and they want to be able to learn on a high level. Okay, so they're not able to read a Gemara in the original, but print it in English. Safari is amazing. You have everything in front of you. And that we've been really focused on that. My husband learned in a lot of the premier yeshivas of the Haredi world. He went to Panovich Yeshiva Ktana. He went to Yeshivat Chevron in Israel.
Panovich, the Yeshiva Chevron. Okay, Lakewood. Yeah. Interesting. Nice challenge.
Interesting challenge. So a lot of the approach is sort of like taking the elite, the brilliance of, you know, the best yeshivas and sort of like democratizing that approach, right? Allowing open access within a serious Orthodox setting. And a lot of people, I think, are looking for that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. So that's the shul. We bought a building, Baruch Hashem, in March.
Wow.
Of this year, right here on 70th and Park. It's a beautiful building. We're incredibly blessed and humbled. And sometimes I walk in there and I just can't believe it's real. It's a gorgeous landmark, the ballroom, gorgeous sanctuary, a library, Beis Medrash that we've sort of breathed new life into from 1925.
Wow. So what's it like, the, I guess, balancing working in real deals, pretty corporate.
Yeah.
Corporate America and being a Rebbetzin.
Yeah.
Is that like fire and water? How does that? I think it's unique. I don't think you usually see a corporate, you know, worker and being a Rebbetzin in the same.
No. And it's more than corporate. It's media. So it's like a really.
Yeah. It's really. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's.
It's intense.
You have to really. You're also part of your job is you have to write about stuff that maybe sometimes you're not always, maybe sometimes doesn't align with the other position in your life.
I rarely have to do that now. I would say there have been a few times, but I feel like my gut. I trust my instinct, and
you could refuse a piece. Basically, you don't have. You could not do a piece.
I mean, we have a nice size team. Someone else could be assigned it. It doesn't have to be me.
Right.
It's definitely challenging. I think it's important as a Rebbetzin in Manhattan. A lot of the young women I talk to, I work with, and I'm talking about like all the time, like all my extra time is really devoted to the shul. I'm not even talking about my poor children. But really like evenings, the moment my kids are in bed is shul time for me. It's Rebbetzin time. Early mornings sometimes, even before my workday starts, I'll get coffee with a new member, a young woman in the community. That's like my day-to-day cadence. And one of the things I hear from a lot of young women is that they appreciate that I understand the world that they live in, that most of them are not just working, they're not just working jobs, they're career women. They have different pursuits and they may be totally different industries from me, but they're, you know, they're in grad school or they're they're climbing the ladder in some financial firm, whatever it is that they're doing. And they often tell me that they appreciate that I embody that juggle, that balance, and that also, like, I'm not taking the conventional approach for an Orthodox Rebbetzin. For them is validating, because I think for them, especially for women who are looking to grow in observance, which is a big challenge, by the way, I think it's actually harder for women than men in certain spaces, for them to see that validated, and for them to see a woman who's doing that and saying, you know what, like, I don't have to make the kugel from scratch. It's okay. Like, I'm still from, you know, like, for them to see that, I think is really important, because they understand that it's accessible to them, that they too can be religious and intelligent and engaging with the world and passionate about all these things. Not that I'm perfect right. in any way, but I feel like that the pressure to be that pushes me to do that, even when it's so hard.
If you're hurt or find yourself in an accident, which, let's be real, it happens more than we like it, you need the right lawyer on your side. That's when you call the Rothenberg Law Firm. For over 55 years, they've been a cornerstone in our community, helping people just like you. They've won and collected billions of dollars for their clients. And the best part, if they don't win, you don't pay. When you choose Rothenberg, you're not just getting a lawyer, you're getting a trusted friend who treats you like family. They understand that a personal injury can turn your life upside down. So they go well beyond just legal representation. They will make sure your medical bills are paid by the appropriate parties and that your family is taken care of during this rough time. Everybody knows Rothenberg, so you know they're the name you can trust. So if you ever find yourself needing legal help, remember to head to injurylawyer.com or call them 1-800-624-8888 for a free case evaluation. Make sure to keep the Rothenberg Law Firm on speed dial, because not every injury lawyer has the resources to stand up to the big corporations and insurance companies. They've been fighting the good fight for over 5 decades, and they are not slowing down. I hope you never need them, but if you do, the Rothenberg family is there for you. This episode is also sponsored by my friends at Town Appliance. Yes, because you may need new appliances now. Your appliances are talking to each other like, guys, this is the end. What are we doing? We're not working that well anymore. Why hasn't he replaced us? Or your empty new house is be like, yo, can't wait to get some appliances up in here, you know? This is going to be fun. Regardless of what your appliances are saying or not saying, which you should really call someone if they are, head to townappliance.com. Ever since 1979, they have been the number one appliance store for the Jewish community. You can even send them a message on WhatsApp and get in touch with one of their top-level customer service salespeople. Go ahead. Town Appliance is the place for you.
Where does Misora play a role in what you do? Because it's really freshening things up. It's trying to show that Yiddishkeit is very vast, and even Orthodoxy. You could be this, you could be that, mm-hmm. you could wear different hats. And of course, following the Torah yeah. and the mitzvahs and what we could do and what we can't do, we have a certain Misora, right? Some people are, you know, very, very strong on. Where does that play a role in your community?
I mean, everything is tied to Misora. We don't use that word. As the child of Bali Tshuva, I find it's often used as a code word for saying, if you don't have the Misora, it's because you're missing a link in the family, which is a whole other story.
Is that like people say that to Bali Tshuva?
I hear it. I hear a lot because I hear it also, you know, I'm in Kirov and rabbinic spaces on one hand. And on the other hand, I feel very much I identify with my congregants. You know what's so interesting? My in-laws really modeled this for me from the very beginning when I got married. My father-in-law was the chief rabbi of Moscow for 30 years. And doing that impossible work, I don't know how they did it. My mother-in-law started a school there. They literally devoted 30 years of their lives to building Jewish community life there. And he left when the war started, when he understood that he would have to make a statement in support of the war, and he refused to. So watching them in action in the early years of my marriage before they left was very instructive, because I saw that, I think one of the big challenges in Kirov is a lot of people sort of look at congregations as like projects, you know, Or like I will often hear with Kira Robertson's, well, how many people do you host every Shabbos for dinner? How many people have you made from, right? Like there are metrics that are expected. And my in-laws modeled something very different. Their model was, we are truly just friends with our shul members, with our community members, that these people became lifelong friends for them. And now even living Baruch Hashem in Israel, they're able to maintain those friendships and just like normal. Like you don't have to, you know, come at it with that top-down approach. So I'm very sensitive to these things. Also as a daughter of Bali Tshuva, because it's very hard for me growing up, I think, entering the community. It was like a second immigration for my family, trying to normalize, trying to figure out what's normal, what's not, like speaking the language. It was such a different culture. So I'm very sensitive to those words. Coming back to the point about Masora, everything is about reconnecting to authentic tradition. And sometimes I think we often miss the boat on what is actually authentic, and we can sort of maybe have an academic conversation about what that looks like. But from my perspective, I think we want to help people, ourselves included, by the way, reconnect and get re-inspired with that connection to the past. I often talk about, for example, one of the common challenges I have as a Revitan is working with kallahs, okay? Learning with them before their weddings. It's something that is extremely demanding, but extremely important. And it's something that I don't take lightly. And it's something that I rarely feel I can even hand off to other people because I'm so careful with the way that I do it. I have my own approach to it. And one of the things I talk a lot about with young women is that it's okay if your mother never went and it's okay if your grandmother never went, but I'm telling you that your great, great, great grandmother did go and you can be that repaired link in that chain. And for many women that, you know, it speaks to them. They understand that there's something very heavy is on their shoulders and they can really reconnect.
Yeah, I interviewed Flynn Goldstein recently from Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, somewhere in Philadelphia. I don't know the exact city. And he said this exact thing. He said he was able to connect inside to not necessarily his father doing it or not his grandfather, but a great-great-grandfather that was probably wearing the same tefillin, totally, doing the same mitzvahs that he's trying to do now. Yeah. And that's really meaningful. That's really important to bring those people and say, like, this is the future of the Jewish people right here. If you can continue it, if you can hold on to it.
Yeah.
And here in Manhattan, I mean, that's assimilation, as we mentioned.
Assimilation is strong, but also just there's a big disconnect. People are really disconnected.
Why do people feel that it's not theirs? Why are people feeling Yiddishkeit, Torah, Judaism? It's very nice. Meaning, I hear even in the way certain celebrities who are Jewish, they talk about Yiddishkeit like they're almost there, but they have like this divide up. Like they can't give up the fish fillet at McDonald's, but they keep their own version of kosher. But like, why can't we get the buy-in?
Buy-in on what? On there's like faith and then there's observance, right? What would you say?
Well, I think to measure someone's faith is maybe unfair. Like for me to say from the outside, oh, they don't have faith. I'm sure they have faith. What that faith looks like, not me or anyone to talk about their faith. Probably observance. Probably just, you know, is it because of convenience? Is it because they're just not
willing? There are a few factors here. I think number one, a lot of people have bad experiences, traumatizing experiences, just bad experiences with just like a bad rabbi.
Well, that would mean someone was religious at some point.
And well, not necessarily. You went to Sunday school at a Reformed temple somewhere and you just had like, it was boring or it was just, I'm not saying something egregious, just something negative.
Right.
I hear that a lot. A lot of people come, I'm talking about like in their 30s, saying the last time they were in any synagogue, temple, anything was at their bar mitzvah. That the bar mitzvah was the final thing.
Right.
So you definitely have people with bad experiences. Now that's something that's just human error sometimes, and there's impossible to avoid, but it's something we're also very sensitive to. We work very hard on trying to make sure that shul is a positive space. And we look at shul almost as a hospitality endeavor, not only as a house of worship, thinking through details, because we want people to feel in every step of the way, in every part of their experience, that they are truly, they're wanted and they're beloved. Baruch Hashem, we have a capacity issue already in our new building, so it's been challenging. But that's the thing that drives us. The number one is negative experiences. I think number two, people who have had any experience with Jewish institutions or organizations will often have an experience with a very superficial Judaism. Okay. And I see this in modern Orthodox congregations across the board in Manhattan. Okay. You have many rabbis who are afraid of talking about three topics: Kashrus, Shabbos, and Taras Mishpacha. I'm not joking.
Because
they will not talk to you about observance. They don't want to from the pulpit. They're going to tell you, I'm Yisrael Chai, support Israel, don't forget the Holocaust, those types of statements that may have worked for a previous generation. But our generation, I'm 33, and people younger than me are not, it's not enough. By the way, after October 7th, there was definitely a resurgence in spiritual awakening that we've seen certainly here in Manhattan. But it's not enough to be an October 7th or October 8th Jew. It's not enough. It's not, peoplehood is not enough.
You're saying you need observance.
Achdus, you need some sort of observance. You need also commitment. You need commitment to a community. You may not be in the place that you're ready to keep Shabbos yet, but you need to be within a community where that is the goal. That's the aspiration. By the way, some of this, Shabbos, I'm talking about like getting married, having families, like fundamental parts of what it means to be, aspiring towards at least. And I think those are things that we talk about all the time in shul. It doesn't mean that someone who's not observant, who's not married, is not doing their part in being active, conscious Jews. But we want to create a space that talks about these things, that's not afraid of talking about those things. And I think a lot of people have bad experiences because they think that it's just enough to wear a Jewish star or whatever, have a certain tote bag or go to Zay bars or whatever it is that like American sort of secular New York Judaism looks like. And it's not working. It's not working because their kids and their grandchildren are marrying out, I'm telling you. So I think there's a misunderstanding of what that looks like. So number one is an emphasis on observance. Number two, also on learning, on real learning of actual Torah. Not Hashem loves you Torah, not, you know, little Musar Shmoozes that people think work. No, like real Torah. There are people who don't know who Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are. Okay? We have to sit down and teach them. Some of the things that I've been driven to, I've never thought I would be in this position. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, if you know Aleph, teach Aleph, right? And I think about that a lot. Like this position has pushed me to take on learning in a whole new way because it's forced me to teach. It's forced me to understand, you know what? I may not be a great scholar, but I know a thing or two. I could teach. And it's pushed me. In the last 3 years, I started teaching every Shabbos after Kiddush. I give a shir, usually parsha related, not always. And it's pushed me. It's pushed me to grow, and it's pushed me to push other people to grow.
We'll be right back to this episode. A quick word from my friends at Infinity Land Services, because when you need title done, you don't want to be scrambling around trying to figure out why the guy that you hired is not there or why the deal might fall through because title wasn't taken care of properly. No more stories, no more excuses. You call Infinity Land Services. Yes, it could be you're buying $100 million in real estate or $1 million or $500,000, whatever it is. You want to make sure title is taken care of. And there's only one place to go. That is ILSTitle.com, ILSTitle.com. So, you're buying your first home, your third home, your fifth home, whatever it is. You make sure you tell your agent, you tell your broker, hey, when it comes to title, I got it covered. Heard about these people, Infinity Land Services. And that's who I'm going to use. My friends Mark Hirschkowitz and his team are the number one place when it comes to title. No excuses, no stories, no novels, just title done right. That is ILSTitle.com.
It really resonates with me what you just said about it not being enough to just be that October 8th Jew. And while it's nice that some people who didn't identify with their Yiddishkeit at all are maybe now coming to, it doesn't end there. It doesn't stop there. We need to be serious about what it looks like going forward. It's interesting because, you know, I come from like the yeshiva world, I'd say. You know, that's my background. So the yeshivas I went to, the Hashem loves you approach is very popular within those circles now.
Yeah.
I think the kids do know Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were. I just didn't think they knew that Hashem loved them.
Mm.
So I think
every really, community has different challenges, right, and different things that are missing there.
And it's interesting that like this community, it's almost like mirrored. Like it needs the opposite. Meaning the front community know they know.
Yeah.
Let's say they know the Avos, they know the Torah, they learn. But do they have the fire? Do they have the neshama? And the becoming from community might have the soul and the passion of Yiddishkeit, but they don't know who they come from.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's true. I think they're, for the most part, that's a good assessment. Yeah.
Of like, wow.
I would say from versus yeshiva affiliated versus not. But they're both so important, right? They're both so important. I think a lot of people are sort of like, they may be turned on by some, you know, schmooze they hear at some like, you know, hippy dippy Friday night dinner somewhere downtown. And they think that, you know, they're now, you know, connected, but that connection very rarely lasts long. That's not a lot of what shul is about. What we've had to realize through the process of building is that it's about encouraging people to commit. This is your community. This is your chavra. By the way, it doesn't have to be our shul. Find another shul, whatever, right. Any shul. Find your community, find your friends, find your chevra. Where is the place that you're showing up? What's your third place? There's a concept in sociology that you have a first place, which is your home. Your second place is your work, where you spend most of your day. And your third place is a sort of a social club, some sort of setting where people gather. And part of, I think, the problem in American society is that we've lost that. American society is coming apart at the seams because we don't have, the typical American doesn't go to church anymore. The typical American doesn't have a right. country club or like a soccer group or something, whatever it was, a beer pub, whatever it was where people used to gather. And shul is an incredible force in that. And I've seen people's lives changed in so many ways.
Yeah, as a frum Jew, when I, just looking at the world at large, if we just talk about America,
mm-hmm.
how far it's going away from God and godliness and spirituality. When I see in a let's say a sports arena, or when I see in a really premier public place that there is prayer, and even if they're not worshiping the same way I do in Yiddishkeit, but just the fact that they believe in a power above them, that is in itself, I find comfort in that. And I know that Lubavitcher Rebbe was a very big supporter of having a moment of silence in schools.
Yeah.
I know they're trying to bring it back. You know, they took away Pledge of Allegiance, I think, right. most places. I remember when I was in Yeshiva, they had Pledge of Allegiance.
Me too.
Yeah. They don't anymore. But having a moment of silence that people can just literally look inwards and feel something. The world is going so fast and they're going so far away from it.
Yeah.
And the Jewish people really need to... We really need to like hold on tight
and reconnect with those things. I people don't realize, I find often, how powerful these ancient traditions really are. Traditions, laws, whatever they are. People don't realize like how much it can change you to have that type of, and by the way, growing up in the Frum community, you don't realize it because it's just your norm.
It's like, yeah, it's part of your life.
Tati goes to Minyan every morning. Yeah, sure. Like it's not, people who are introduced to this later in life are, once they really understand what it is, are amazed by it. And I feel like from people don't even understand sometimes the blessing that they have in having that in their lives. They think, okay, whatever, Minyan, oh, I woke up late or this and that, like it becomes like it's a drag. But people who don't have it, who come to it later, it's very inspiring for someone who grew up for the most part religious, because you see it for the first time in their eyes. It's the same way I feel. I used to, I staffed two times in OU birthright trips when I was like 21, and being able to take like 30 Jewish kids to Israel and stepping off in Ben Gurion Airport with them and seeing their eyes light up. It's like seeing Israel afresh through someone else's eyes. It's the same thing. I feel the same way with doing this work here in Manhattan. It's like seeing people either new to observant Judaism. By the way, some people grew up religious and never really saw it in an inspiring or passionate light, like what you said. They may have known who Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are, but they didn't know Hashem loves them. Or even I would go deeper than Hashem loves you. They don't know they don't really look at Torah and the way that it applies practically to our lives. Like, they don't really understand it until they're introduced to a different perspective on it. And seeing that is very inspiring for us.
Yeah, it really, it pains me. I listen to a lot of podcasts, not necessarily religious mm-hmm. people at all, but podcasts that you have the host will say, oh, you know, they'll make a joke and someone's, oh, Refu Shalema, Baruch Hashem. And I'm like, yeah. What? Like, this guy is Jewish? Like, and they're so far removed. It's just really, it's a chaval. It's such a chaval.
It's a chaval, but you see also the thing like that I've seen in the last 3 years, there's an immense thirst for true, for truth. And I don't want to say that we have the truth, because I think that's extremely arrogant. And I think that's a problem with a lot of organizations and whatever who say that. But they're looking for something. People are looking. And they're looking for it in a place that has an element of vulnerability also. I think that's another important piece that many people in organizational work don't realize. Our whole crazy story that I'm telling you is Siyata Deshmaya, a total miracle. We never expected anything like this to happen. But I literally felt the hand of Hashem throughout to this day. And our whole story was, for me, very indicative of the power of vulnerability in Jewish community spaces and also Jewish education, because we started the shul in a moment of the utmost vulnerability. We were brought down to our knees publicly, and to get up and to keep going. And there was sort of like, there was no more masks. I think a lot of people in, I certainly felt that way before all of this happened to us. I think a lot of people in congregational work, clergy wives, not just Jewish. I read Christian pastors, for heaven's sake, and their wives. I read what they write about their experiences serving congregations. There's a certain element of distance from your congregants. Or there's an element of like sort of keeping, you know, always a smile, but right. Not really always being authentic.
The inception of your shul is the opposite. They saw you on the ground.
They saw us literally on the ground. There was no room for artifice. And that, I think that was an important, a potent piece of that, you know, that equation that was able to help us build, because we were just ourselves. And we were so honest about like our struggles. And my husband spoke about it in his drushas, like not just the situation, just in general, like we became much more free, much more ourselves. And that's a really powerful thing.
Something that you like to do is advocate for people going through things. I guess, tell me a little bit about the time you spend doing that.
It's interesting. I feel like this last, the early years of my quote-unquote career as a writer, as a journalist, and as an advocate / activist were very much, it was me doing a lot of talking. And I feel like 3 years ago, not that Hashem speaks to me directly, but I almost felt like Hashem was saying to me, okay, you've preached about this for all these years, now go do it. You've been saying this, now I want you to go and actually do it. You've been talking about women's leadership in the Orthodox community and how important it is, blah, blah, blah. Okay, yala, here, do it. And I feel like that's been my story the last, most recently. It comes into all the issues. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a specific issue you wanted to discuss. Agunos, for example, we've had, you know, a few cases
that's a hot button issue.
Hot button issue, especially right now. I have a lot of dear friends who are very much involved in this fight. I've reported on it a number of times, and now I'm in a different position where I have a shul. And if I find out there is a Masarev get in my shul, I will kick him out. I will make an executive decision. I don't even talk to my husband sometimes about it. I have security escort him out. Like, they know, people know that in this shul, the Rebbetzin does not tolerate
and that. That's halacha backs such a thing.
Halacha backs such a thing. But there are other issues as well that we've had over the years, not frequently, but from time to time. And I think, by the way, that's a really important piece. And also in building a shul that is safe and building a shul where people who are, let's just put it bluntly, dangerous to the wider community, that people know that is not tolerated here. I don't care how much money you have. You are not accepted in this congregation if you are someone who is doing momish terrible things. And this happened a few times over the years, not often, obviously, but it's happened a few times. And the last time that this happened, one of the few young women approached me and said, "Thank you so much. We so appreciate what you did." And the reason that I was able to do it was because I think in most shuls, the Rebbetzin is sort of like, it's a chatzi situation. It's not like a real,
Rebbetzin is not a, it's not a thing where I grew up.
Yeah,
there's not a lot of Rebbetzins.
Yeah, you don't. But I've taken it very seriously since the very beginning. And we very much, my husband and I are like partners in everything to a fault. Sometimes I'm like, "Benji, I don't need to edit that for the shul. We'll figure it out." But truly, 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 I've been involved in every aspect of the shul, building it. And I think it's essential, because what happens is when you have a woman on the side of, we have a community that is, let's call it a spade a spade. It is gender segregated. Men and women have different experiences. We have different spaces.
Sure.
Right?
In the world,
good. There's challenges with it. The problem is that when you only have leadership on one side of the mechitza, 50% of the community's experiences are not heard, are not seen, and their safety sometimes is not taken seriously. So when you have a situation where some young women approach me and say, "There's someone here who's not someone we want in the shul, like who's really, you know," that is something I can take very seriously. And that's one of the things that made me realize how important it is that women take serious leadership roles in their communities. It's a hard thing to do, especially with the way that organizations are already built and like baked in. But when you're talking about if a community has an opportunity, let's say to hire a rabbinic couple or to build something from scratch, I think this is the only way to go. Because I think that, by the way, that's another thing people often ask about the shul is, you know, it's become Baruch Hashem very successful with younger people. 40% of our membership is under age 40, which is very unusual in Manhattan. And I always say it's because in the shul, women count. Young women want to come to shul. We very much believe in this being a priority. And what happens when the young women come to shul? The young men want to come to shul, right? It's a scene. People meet.
What would you say to someone listening to this and they say, "This is modern day feminism. This is not something that we can ascribe to. If we start going down this path, we'll end up, you know, God knows where." What would you say to that?
Great question. I think so many ways to answer that question. I don't think this is modern day feminism at all.
You're able to appreciate a distinction between feminism where it has gone in society and the version
that
you have.
And I also think that there's a lot of greatness in traditionalist approaches to, for example, women's spaces. I've gotten pushback on that sometimes in shul. "Oh, we should do everything together, men and women." Like, for example, I have a women's Beit Midrash that I do every few weeks. And either I teach a shiur or someone else teaches a shiur. We try to do high-level stuff. And like serious, source sheets, at least an hour long. You're coming, you're learning in the Beit Midrash. And I've gotten pushback on it. "Why women only? We should have men there. It's an opportunity to connect." I think that there is something very much lost in today's society where everything is always together. And there's nothing like creating some spaces that are, let's say, female only or male only, that I also see in the shul. We have occasional male only events, shiurim as well. The vibe is different. The environment is different. Like, do you want to sit in a shiur and worry about, you know, what so-and-so is thinking of you, your prospects with this person, your past with this person? It's not a good situation. So I think there's a lot of, I'm sort of unpredictable in my approach. And I think my husband is as well. That's why we're a good match, in that we sometimes take a very traditionalist approach on something. And sometimes we're just like, we're going to think with a totally fresh look. When it comes to women's leadership, I don't think this is an issue of an ism. This is an issue of seriously pikuach nefesh for many communities. And I say this not as, now I'm not talking about as someone in Manhattan. I'm talking about this as someone who I receive tons and tons of messages and letters from women around various communities talking about the challenges that they face, that they don't really feel they have someone to turn to. They don't have an advocate with Rabbanim per se. I'm not even talking about Aguna issues. That's an obvious example of this. But even quote unquote smaller things, women are in many communities disenfranchised. And I think that's also created a certain, like a, almost like a brain drain among women. Women are not, we don't have the same access to high Torah learning opportunities, leadership and local organizations. There's a lot more work that needs to be done on the women's side of the mechitza. And I respect the mechitza. I never want to take it down. I'm happy with it. But there needs to be leadership on that side of the mechitza that understands us and our needs.
Amazing. I think you're doing amazing work.
Thank you.
The running title I have for this episode, like the Robertson of Manhattan, Robertson of New York. It's really cool. Like it's you guys are doing really God's work in trying to bring back, you know, lost souls, but also to give a real authentic Yiddishkeit to those who are currently practicing.
Totally. Come for Shabbos.
Yeah, God willing. You know, this is such a nice, you guys have an Eri for now.
Don't answer the question. There is an Eri in Manhattan.
There is an Eri. There's an Eri everywhere. okay, very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for watching and listening to this episode. Make sure to comment below who you'd like to see us interview next. One of you will be a lucky winner. Of course, make sure to head to meaningfulminute.org/the game and purchase the Meaningful People game, new to market. Hundreds have sold. And trust me, you want this. Order it right now. You'll have it for sure by next Shabbos. And you'll be playing this with your family, with your kids, with your friends. And if you're going on a date maybe, then even better. This is perfect for that. Go ahead to meaningfulminute.org/the game. And get your hands on it today. Now, I want to thank you all for listening and watching this episode. It is my hope and my goal to bring to you every single week important conversations, meaningful conversations, things that we can listen to together, that we could think about together and grow from together. That is my only goal here. So I appreciate you tuning in. Until next week, everybody, have an awesome, awesome week.